My name is Philip Yanos. I'm a professor, mental health advocate, and New Yorker. Welcome to Exiles in the City, a podcast focused on topics related to the treatment of marginalized groups in urban areas. The podcast takes inspiration from my book, Exiles in New York City, Warehousing the Marginalized on Ward's Island, which was published by Columbia University Press this past April. The book can be ordered online and found at local bookstores in New York City. Thank you for tuning in. I'm honored to welcome Dr. Evan Auguste as my fifth guest today. Evan is an assistant professor of psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, where I also work. He has a PhD in clinical psychology, with a major area of focus in forensic psychology from Fordham University, and previously was faculty at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He identifies as a Haitian African-American man, which has informed his work on examining how the U.S.'s history of anti-blackness has shaped psychological realities both in and outside of the country's borders, and is the editor of the recently published book, The Carceral State, Forensic Psychology and the Black Resistance, Let Them Not Be Forgotten, which discusses the ways in which Black psychology and forensic psychology can be integrated. He has led the Association of Black Psychologists Sawubana Healing Circles program to promote healing from an African-centered framework. He's also a board member for the Institution for the Development of Human Arts, an organization that offers transformative mental health trainings that I've also been involved with for the past 7 years or so. And directly relevant to my book, while he was a graduate student, he completed a clinical training rotation at Kirby Forensic Psychiatric Center on Ward's Island. Evan has received numerous awards for his work, more than I can detail here, but most notably the Association of Black Psychologists President's Service Award. So I'm excited to talk with Evan about a number of topics today. Thank you so much, Evan, for joining me.
This is deeply, deeply exciting for me. I really appreciate when psychology don't stay within solely psychological methods. They dig into the historical context. So I've been telling you this. I don't think you fully knew the degree to which I was excited to be on this podcast with you and to dig into some of this work. So thank you.
That's really, really exciting to hear. Great. So let's start. My first question has to do with the topic of your recently published book, which discusses the ways that Black psychology and forensic psychology can coexist into a discipline you call maroon psychology. And I don't know if that's your term or if you've got it elsewhere, you can tell us about that. Mm-hmm. And you state, we need a forensic psychology that can authentically assess the full psychological and political lives of people seeking to exist and thrive in this country. So how do you see maroon psychology operating in practice to better serve marginalized people, especially Black people, who are intersecting with both the mental health and justice systems?
It's a beautiful question, and I'm going to answer it in two ways. So the first part, right, the maroon psychology, where does this come from? So when I first began writing and thinking about these intersections of these two applied forms of psychology, in a way, I thought Black psychology was sufficient. But what I saw was examining different theories, examining people's distinct practice, it kind of became clear that Black psychology means so many different things to so many different people. And what I really wanted to hammer in on was a psychology that was specifically and intentionally applied towards a liberatory outcome. There are a lot of people who will, some honor, again, like the work of Marcus Garvey, some people honor the work of Frantz Fanon, who again was engaged in material liberation, but think a lot about liberation in a cognitive, in a sense, immaterial sense, which is powerful work. I had found that in our current political context that it wasn't sufficient to meet the moment where we were. So the idea of maroon psychology was hearkening back to the political aspirations, the spiritual ambitions of those first African peoples who were enslaved in the Americas, who, as Cedric Robinson talks about, weren't trying to reform or refine the American process. You know, those people in Haiti, those people in Jamaica weren't fully concerned. Not all of them were fully concerned with exalting the British or the French project. A lot of them already had political, spiritual, social ideas of ways of existing and sought to pursue that. So the idea of Maroon psychology, kind of pulling a little bit from Asa Hilliard, was how can we advance a psychology that doesn't seek to refine these systems of harm, but instead seeks to kind of co-create systems of justice that lean into those distinct histories, those distinct ambitions to meet our political moment.
Right? And it so sounds I tell like,
people, oh, go yeah. ahead.
Sorry, it sounds like you really want to make sure that we're not leaving out, you know, people who intersect with mental health systems, you know, especially people who intersect with hospitals and systems in incarceral settings, not leave that part of the Black experience out, right?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. When I again started doing more work with the Association of Black Psychologists, we'll probably dig into a bit more of that. When I was going to a lot of these community health forums where people were talking about Black psychology, it was this psychology of refining, right, the mind, refining the way we exist in this context of the United States, which to that point didn't help us meet the people who were actually actively captured. Right? There's people who are actually actively captured and we need to be in service to. So I wanted to tie it very tightly. And I've had some back and forth with some of my colleagues who I respect deeply who say, you know, I don't see my work as a forensic project. I'm like, well, that's my piece, right? Here are the bars. We have to rend them open, right?
Right.
Harriet Tubman wasn't doing it was a psychological process, but it was a process of material freedom also, right? So, and I also say, the way I'm thinking about it, the name I'm referencing this ethic, you know, is not one that I created, but it's trying to help people more kind of concretely name what they're doing.
Right.
Right. So that's how I try to talk about it, which is why I root it in the life work of Thomas Hilliard to show like, yo, this is not me. People have been engaged in this type of work. Here, let's give it a name so we can be clear about what we're talking about.
We'll get to Thomas Hilliard in a second, because I think that would be really interesting for folks to hear about. But just thinking in practice, like how do you see somebody who's practicing from a Maroon psychology perspective in a forensic setting, like, you know, a state hospital or, you know, a treatment unit in a jail like at Rikers or something, how do you see them bringing this into their work to do things differently?
And so this is what becomes really interesting. We have in chapter two, we talk about some of the distinct ethics that people might apply in a given setting. I write a bit in the first chapter where it requires you to have a bit of a distinct mindset. Right? A lot of our psychological paradigms or ethical paradigms are about how can I refine my professional identity and professional practice. When we start talking about Maroon psychology, we're thinking about psychology politically. We're thinking about the political positioning of psychology, right? And how can you as a person leverage that political positioning, right, to advance justice, liberation, whatever have you. Right? And so the question becomes, I refer to this briefly in one of the, a subsection of the first chapter, but for people who are within those settings, often it's a practice of fugitivity. Right. I think people often come to me and they ask, you know, how could I apply an anti-racist practice in this context? And it's like, well, let's be clear. This is a carceral context. Right. That's what this is. Right. This context is doing harm. Right. And so the question becomes for you is, what are the ways within those ideas of fugitivity that you can do, that you can leverage to make that person's life better or, again, to guide that person towards freedom?
So it needs to be explicit that you're advocating for people to get out of those settings. Obviously, there are things that are beyond your control, but that's something that a person working from the Maroon psychology perspective would be open about, I guess.
Well, it's, and as I say, strategic, right? Like it's who are the people that you are committed to? You know, so that's not to say you go in on your job interview on day one and say like, hey, I'm trying to press the button and let everybody run out. But to be like, really clear with yourself and again, your communities that here's the ethic that I'm going into. right? You should have a very clear ethic, because this is how I think about it, you know? And this is, again, because of a lot of your life's work, a lot of the work of people who are here. I think the science at this point is clear, right? I think we know and understand the way that these systems impact communities, the way they negatively harm individuals. We know there have been several reports of just rampant human rights violations at these state hospitals. And so our science is clear. Right? We know that there is a concerted political effort, nonetheless, to invest in these carceral forms of care. So at a certain moment, we have to be very clear-eyed about what we are up against. And so I hearken back to some people who were at the Central Lunatic for the Colored Insane, for instance, as long as that was the first state hospital that was used to capture African people in the United States with quote unquote mental illness, things like Jacob Tamania. And you had nurses there, right, in their fugitivity, who try to fabricate reports so certain people didn't get lobotomized. That's not a part of a standard practice. That has nothing to do with the ethics. That has to do with an appeal to humanity, right? An appeal to justice beyond the confines of professional ethics. And so that's where I ask people to think about more clearly and honestly.
Yeah. So it's almost like you're kind of you're a double agent in a sense. If you're working from this perspective, you're working on the inside, but you're also acting to advance this liberation agenda at the same time within the confines of what you're allowed to do.
Exactly. And this is the piece too. A lot of people, and this is why I always want to say, there's nothing that I'm writing that I feel like I have come up with. It's stuff that I feel like I have been taught and shared. I know a lot of people who've been doing this work, and they feel isolated. They feel alone.
Right.
They feel right that they're completely on the outskirts. You know, what I want this to do is to be a message like, no, you are a part of a lineage. You are part of a legacy of a lot of people who are trying to push the way that we care for our people forward. Like, we will reflect on this period of time and applaud you for what you do, even though right now, right, you're being seen as, whether it be, I've had people say, like, I feel like I'm unethical. I've had people demean me and my competence. And with time, we will see that you've done the right thing.
So we're talking a lot about history and the importance of knowing about it, right? So, you know, one of my quotes that I like is from the song Buffalo Soldier by Bob Marley. If you know your history, then you know where you're coming from, right? So people who listen to this podcast are generally interested in history, and I get into a lot of history in my book. And you discuss some of the history of the Association of Black Psychologists in your book, and you just talked about Thomas Hilliard. So can you briefly summarize some of this history and why you think it's important to know about it?
Yeah, of course. So it should be of no surprise, and we couldn't go into the fullness of the history, but when we are talking about the American Psychological Association, we're talking about an organization that for a long time was embedded in the project of a white nationalism, U.S. imperialism, in very specific, very direct ways.
Right.
There's so many things that people could read, and so we're not going to get into the fullness of that history. And I believe it was 1967. In 1967, Martin Luther King gets invited to give an address at the American Psychological Association, right? And so already at this time, we see this, I mean, what he would talk about, like the kind of the passive white liberalism, that even as psychology broadly is engaged in this project of white nationalism, it doesn't stop them from inviting a Martin Luther King, you know, to give a speech and to celebrate that and to use that as a feather in the hat. Like, we had one of his last speeches. When he's there, he implores psychology to dig deeper into, again, the political lives of people who've been persecuted by these oppressive forces. Right? He speaks about the Vietnam War, right? He's an internationalist in that way. He speaks about the degree to which we need to lean into, why do Black people engage in protest? Why do Black people engage in riot, right? As psychologists, like, this is your responsibility to uplift, right, the civil rights project. You know, he moves towards what he calls psychological maladjustment. I don't want my people to be adjusted to an unjust society. Right. So this is all in the speech he delivers at the APA in 1967. The following year, he's assassinated.
Yeah.
And after a year, the cohort of psychologists had seen that there had been absolutely no shift. Right. I was doing this paper for my history and system class in graduate school, and I couldn't find it again. Their immediate obituary that the American Psychological Association put out after his death, and it was very tepid, right? It was very, well, history will see how Martin Luther King gets remembered. It's like,
wow.
Fascinating, right? Fascinating. Again, it speaks to the ambivalence that the country felt towards him at the time, right? He was not well-liked.
Yeah.
So the year following, some 200 Black psychologists stormed the stage and declared the need for a Black psychology because the American Psychological Association had so clearly and intentionally, right, ran away from this call. And so what became the Association of Black Psychologists put together a, this is my memory, because I didn't sleep very well, but I believe a 10-point plan in honoring the Black Panthers for how to advance the cause of psychology among Black people.
Right. So it was directly influenced by the Black Panthers 10-point plan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I believe that's actually where the American Psychological Association conference might have been in San Francisco, in fact, that year. And so, interestingly enough, at that very same conference, I believe you get Jay Siskin and I believe a handful of forensic psychologists and lawyers who go on to co-create the American Psychological Law Society, right? So at this one organization, at this one conference, you get the foundation of what becomes the Association of Black Psychologists and what becomes APLS, two very distinct disciplines of the supply psychology.
Right. And I've been told that APLS has very poor representation of people of color at this time.
Yeah.
You would know better. I haven't gone to any of those meetings, but...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's dreadful. It's something that they are actively working.
Right.
But I think this, again, clearly demonstrates why, right? Again, you get two distinct fields of applied psychology, one with, I believe, a more clear view of the United States government and what its legal apparatus is doing to Black people, right? A lot of people in the Association of Black Psychologists, influenced, again, by... what is this man's name? Harold Cruz, influenced by Kwame Ture, are understanding Black people as an internal colony, right? So people who do not have a political sovereignty that is respected. And so it is then their mission to uplift the psychological cause, the political cause of Black people, right? They move with that specifically. That's very separate from an APLS, which for the longest time was politically organized to get invited and involved into that very system to then maybe optimize it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So the history really there was like, I want to be at the table. I want to be part of this, these systems of power, you know, police and incarceration, stuff like that. And the messages that you're conveying now and that are coming from what the Association of Black Psychologists was starting are quite different. We want to transform the system. We want to make, you know, if not just, you know, eliminate it, we want to make it fundamentally different.
Yeah. And so this is where you get like the fullness of, right, collective Black consciousness, right, with very distinct interweaving liberatory projects. You have people who are influenced by Marcus Garvey, right? The idea there is a specific form of Black nationalism that they want to move for. You get some people who are influenced by, I believe, like the Black Belt thesis. Like, how can we form a solid Black political bloc within the confines of the United States so we can uplift our interests? You do get a lot of people who are saying, how can we refine and reform these systems in an equitable way? Right. So you get a full range of the distinct ideas. But again, the fullness of them is held at the Association of Black Psychologists. And so this is where I enter with, you know, Thomas Hilliard, who I think is a little known historical figure within Black psychology and forensic psychology, because he emerges at the same time that Black psychology is emerging. He emerges at the same time as forensic psychology is being institutionalized, maybe we can use the word. And he sees these as deeply connected. right? And so Thomas Hilliard, again, brilliant, he goes to work on how we can leverage this new science of, right, Black understanding, our new studies on Black identity, on Black family structure, on Black consciousness as being a life-giving resource. How can we enter that into the legal arena so we can get our people out of prison? I spoke with a few of his, he's transitioned far too early. I believe he passed away in the 90s, about like a couple of decades into his work. So I spoke to a number of his colleagues and they said, what was distinct about the Association of Black Psychologists is everyone got a mission from the community. I spoke with Wade Nobles, who's one of the founders of the Association of Black Psychologists, and said, he said his was to deepen our understanding of psychology as it connects to the African spirit and African identity. There's people like Asa Hilliard who understood his idea of like, I need to better understand how we're kind of threaded with the civilization of Egypt and we can better understand our history as well as perfecting our educational systems. Wade Nobles and some of his other colleagues told me that Thomas Hilliard's mission was getting people out of prison, right? And when I spoke with Patricia Canson Griffith, she said that would be his call if he knew you were writing this book. You said, don't forget them. Don't forget the people who are incarcerated.
You know? And that's why the title, it's in there in the title,
And that's it.
Yeah.
Right, that's it.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like you really have this sense of responsibility to carry on what these, you know, important leaders, you know, brought in. And it's in a sense you're saying they shouldn't be forgotten either, right? The important work that they've done in establishing the Association of Black Psychologists.
And I'll tell you, I'll give you a little bit of like also context for the motivation of the book as well. You know, this was written obviously in a post 2020 context where everybody and their whole family had written and were researching, were learning about anti-racism. Like everybody read their first anti-racist book. Everybody was giving the trainings. And what I found, which was really fascinating, is in forensic psychology spaces and a lot of spaces, people did step one, right? They read the first book and it kind of more or less stopped at our structures are racist.
Yeah.
Damn. Ah, I hate that it had to be so. You're going to write that in the report, like, ah, things are racist, right?
What do we do next?
And there was no follow-up.
Yeah.
Right. And with the lack of follow-up, there's almost an idea of like, this is too complicated. This is too hard. And as I was finishing my degree, I would ask people like, okay, you're talking about structural racism, you know, at this law society, you're talking about structural racism at this court. Do you have, are you doing any assessments of it? Right. Are there any, is it included in any of the reports how that might be affecting this particular person? Right. How about any of the measures on consciousness? People are like, no, we don't really know any of those. And so part of the history was also, and so when I would present about this, people would treat it very pie in the sky. This is very theoretical. Right? But we nonetheless are practitioners, right? We have things that we have to do reports, right? We have to build programming. You know, I get things are racist, but like literally what am I supposed to do? And so the book was an answer to that frustration because not only are there people actively doing things, and I like to, I highlight them in each of the chapters in the book. There's people who are actively using African-centered and culturally grounded measures and assessment to shape their forensic formulations. Like that's actively going on. Those people are actively building alternatives to incarceration, right? As an extension of forensic work. Our forensic work isn't just optimizing the prison. Like we need to be leaning into building other forms of justice in community that we know are more effective. We have that science.
Right. Right.
It was also like, this isn't all new, right? I would also get really frustrated when people would come to me like, oh, Evan, you at the leading edge of us. I was like, no. Like, again, you have to go read the book. You got to go read the history.
Yeah.
Because it's not just me. There's a Thomas Hilliard, right? There's an N.C. Mangyani in South Africa. There's a Louis Mars in Haiti, right? There's been so many people who've done this specific work with success, right? Thomas Hilliard worked on the Angela Davis trial with success. Thomas Hilliard works on the San Quentin Six trial, right? With success. And so these aren't just pie in the sky dreams of what to incorporate. It's a radical method that has demonstrated efficacy that we are, I think, intentionally forgetting. So that's the, I think, the urgency I feel with uplifting some of these stories.
Very powerful and very clear what your aiming to do and how you see it connected to what came before. So I love hearing, you know, accounts of people who sort of know what they're aiming for, right? It's like, it's not just that, you know, you got this degree and now you're kind of, you know, throwing things around to see what sticks, you know. And again, there's so many things that get in the way of us achieving what we want to do, right?
Yeah.
But you still have a focus on what you're aiming for, and that's really important. So let me change slight gears and just ask you a little bit about your experience at Kirby Forensic on Ward's Island while you were a graduate student. And I'm interested in how this experience impacted your career trajectory since then. So obviously my book is about Ward's Island. You know, I'm interested in how we can advance justice for those folks specifically. So what was your experience like there at Kirby?
It broke me. There was a period of time that I could not speak about Kirby without crying.
Wow.
I remember my first few, and mind you, right, my time at Kirby was cut in half because COVID hit in the middle of my time there. And so there were times where I would try to communicate while I was a graduate student, we'd have our supervision, you know, cohort meetings, what I was seeing. And it was to such a sharp degree that people didn't even know how to hold it, right? Mm. Somebody's coming to their supervision. Yeah, this kid, she don't want to go to the bathroom. She's afraid of the toilet. And I'll come in. I watch somebody I watch a psychiatrist lie about somebody's diagnosis so they would get dragged down the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What am I supposed to do with that? Like, what do I say to this person?
Mm.
And if every time I watched that go on in front of me, it felt like a failure. Right? It felt like I'm letting this person down. You know, I would get into, and mind you, I want to be really clear, right? Because this is not everybody at Kirby, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like really thoughtful, passionate people who I saw go in every day, specifically to the point to try to uplift the lives of those people who went there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of the opposite. I saw a lot of people who went there to punish people who were there, right? People who say, I don't want this person to escape judgment, so I'm treating this person as if I was a prison warden. A little bit more backstory, right? I came into graduate school with a bit of a chip on my shoulder because relative to everybody else, I didn't have forensic experience. Mm-hmm. I came in with an interest in racial trauma. I had experience with global and public health. And so I felt like I was always behind when it came to understanding this forensic world. And so that year I doubled up. I did Fordham has a legal clinic. So I was going to the federal prisons, doing the maximum security prisons, doing evaluations. And then on the other days I was going to Kirby. And so the impact was, again, you read all of this, like you read about structural harm. You read about the trauma of institutional racism. You read about psychiatric coercion. But then to watch it, I remember sitting there, like watching somebody advocate for, like, listen, I've been in mental health services before. This is my diagnosis. This is the treatment I need. Some people saying, I tried to get treatment and they kicked me out. And watching psychiatrists laugh in this person's face. Like, don't you think it's crazy that you're disagreeing with us? And then go to the side and tell me, well, we actually just write the same diagnosis for everybody so we can get the paperwork through. Right. And I'm like, I felt what it meant to be marginalized in that moment. Like, this is a person right here who I can see in their eyes is so clearly pleading, this is what I need. And to have that be laughed away and to know no one is going to believe this person because of where they've been placed and how that is categorized their being.
They've been determined to be not competent or you know, to be not, you know, able to make decisions about themselves, you know, by reason of insanity or something like that. So they've been discredited as a person, and you know, in a
exactly
sense.
Exactly. And people don't fully recognize like that. Again, that's what's going on. I never, this is another like just poignant moment. I remember going in, they had us leading groups, and my co-lead, who was a teacher's intern at the time, we go in and she asks, Hey, everybody, what are you excited about? What do you want for Thanksgiving? What kind of meal do you want for Thanksgiving? And somebody just raised their hand like, freedom. That's freedom. It's like, it's clear, like, we're playing a game in people's faces. I think in part, the failure I felt, the pain I felt, some of the vicarious trauma I experienced gave me the urgency that you even heard with me talking about the history. It's like, y'all are telling me that there's no other way that this can be done. And I know that's not true, right? And our science is saying that's not true. And our history is saying that's not true. We have other models that are saying that's not true. So why do we keep leaning into this? Like, what is the psychology there? So that's how it shaped me. It hurt me so deeply to be there.
So you said it broke you, but in a sense you were reborn from this experience, or you were born in a way that gave you a renewed sense of purpose, right? When you came out of it and you kind of made sense of it.
Yeah, and this is just like a bit more about me. Like that is, I think, where I draw like my purpose from, right? What brought me to psychology is my cousin, my senior year of college, died by suicide, and I hated that. I felt like we failed him, and so we could talk about the healing circles, but that's like, I never want anybody to have to be in a situation where they don't have support. And so, boom, how can we spread these healing circles as far and as wide and as big as possible so people can be held and not left alone? And the same thing, once I saw like this is what we're doing to people, there has to be another way, right? And that's to just to add to your piece, that's what my mother had said also. My mother, I asked her, like, yo, I want to quit. And I wanted my mom to be like, it's okay, don't worry, baby, like, just tell them you're done. And she's like, no, Evan, I think you need to be here. But I think for all the stuff that you say you want to do, like, you can't do that until you get through this.
And of course, it was a turbulent time for everybody because of the pandemic and the reckonings around the George Floyd murder and things like that. So all of that was happening at the same time as you were dealing with your own personal reckoning and your experience there. And
That's it. That's
and
it.
so you mentioned briefly the healing circles, and that's something that did you get into that after that experience while you were at grad school?
So boom, there you go, right there, right? So 2020 hits, a lot of the externships shut down, a lot of our training shuts down. And right around that time, then president of the Association of Black Psychologists, Theopia Jackson, I'm the chair elect for the student circle of the Association of Black Psychologists. And they tapped me because they wanted the intergenerational board working on their new healing circles that they wanted to make for COVID-19. Right? We were asked by Baba Leonard Dunstan, who is the founder of the Black Family Summit. He transitioned last year. He's saying the people that we're servicing, right, are Black firefighters, are Black people on the front line. They're experiencing disproportionate just trauma. Right. They're seeing it on the front lines and they're going back home and it's disproportionate death there. We need some type of psychological something, And so I got tapped, Tania Lodge, who's also in the book, was tapped, a number of other people, to kind of co-construct the Sauerbone Bone Healing Circle model, which was a virtual crisis response for anti-Black racism and trauma. And so just to tie the thread really clearly, right, I immediately go from Kirby shutting down to all that energy that we're talking about. They tap me for the healing circle. That's where all of that goes. So all of that, I'm wake up 9 a.m., going to sleep 7 p.m. We're just building, building, building. And we rolled the model out in about, I want to say, a month. And within 3 months, I think we'd had 100 to 200 people trained.
So the last thing I'm going to ask you about has to do with kind of being an advocate and partnering with people with lived experience. So just a little bit about my story. So I started training in the 1990s, and People who know about me know about, I learned about the recovery movement, and I connected with a guy named Ed Knight, who was the head of the Mental Health Empowerment Project in New York State. And he became my guide into the, what was called at the time the consumer survivor ex-patients movement. And then I read in, read On Our Own by Judy Chamberlain, and I kind of dug into that history. And I've tried to be a partner to that movement, from that time on in my career, the, 30 or so years at that time. So how did you get involved with the Institute for the Development of the Human Arts, which we were talking a little bit about, that you have been a board member for, and what do you think should be the role of collaboration, between professionals and people lived experience in order to advocate for the kind of change that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a beautiful question. So, and as anybody, if you listen to it, you'll gather, like, 2020 was a very formative year.
Yeah, yeah.
So all this directly, like, flows. Mm-hmm. So you go from Kirby to the pandemic, to the co-construction of the healing circles. Later that year or early next year, I have a number of friends. Or I have one friend in particular who'd seen both, who was volunteering with the Institute for the Development of Human Arts when they were doing one of their series, I believe on, Jesse's gonna kick my ass. If it was on decolonial healing or healing methodologies from the global south. And they got the brilliant Bhargavi Davar, who also transitioned last year, who's doing fantastic work with Bapu Trust in India. And they reached out to me to partner with the healing circles that were rooted in African-centered psychology, right? Indigenous African ways of being. And so I found out about Ida. I started reading their content, and I was immediately like in love, because to the point, a lot of Black psychology I had been seeing, again, met the radical political moment, but nonetheless had a lot of people who over time had become traditional psychologists. And so still, when it came to disability justice, when it came to ideas of mad liberation, did not dig into the conditions for those people. When I saw Ida, I was like, oh, this is can be such a brilliant thread to tie, right? This history of psychology rooted in indigenous knowing with this clear, consistent commitment to the people that are so often forgotten in these hospitals. So when I presented it, I think both brought to them, I think a lot of people in those spaces, again, they might know Fanon, because Fanon has penetrated so many different spaces, friends Fanon. But this lineage, this legacy of a Black political psychology actually does remain fairly niche. Like niche. If you're not at an HBCU, if you're not at FAMU, if you're not at Howard, you might not ever come into contact with it. And so I think understanding and seeing these other forms of political psychology, other ways of doing it, it blended so well with the causes that they were advancing. And so when, I believe it was last, no, it was 2 years ago, I was asked to be on the board, I immediately hopped on that. I immediately hopped on that, because again, for anybody who's listened this far, that's the clear piece, is how can we take these historical traditions and use them towards material benefit? And Ida, with the amount of education that we're doing an evaluation for their decarcerating program right now in my lab, and we're seeing how it's shifting people's engagement with practice. It seemed like such a great partnership in really advancing this work. So that, it's been an honor to be on the board.
Did you get to meet Celia Brown before she passed away? I mean,
I did not.
You did not? Yeah, so she was one of the kind of the, the mothers of the, lived experience movement, a Black woman, here in New York City. And she was involved with Ida from the beginning. And there's a photo on the Ida website where, like, I'm sitting next to her. So it's kind of cool. If you go on the Ida website, it's from the early in-person days, and, I'm there. So,
love it.
Yeah.
That's the end of today's episode of Exiles in the City. I want to thank my guests for joining me and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please subscribe to the Substack to be informed of when future episodes are released. Please spread the word. Thank you and stay strong.